This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Hugh Gusterson to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. Gusterson is a professor in the Department of Anthropology at UBC, and he holds a PhD from Stanford University, having worked at other institutions such as MIT and George Washington University before coming to UBC in 2020. So, just to start off, I think, Gurman, you have some questions to ask.
Yeah, maybe could you tell us a bit more about your work and how you got interested in anthropology and how you sort of drifted over into studying the polygraph?
Well, I got interested in anthropology, I think because I took a gap year before I was an undergraduate. I'm British originally, and there's a tradition in the UK of taking a gap year before you go to university. I was brought up in a very parochial, white, middle-class family in the UK, and I spent my gap year in Morocco working in a school run by the Save the Children Fund for kids with polio. They were kids who'd survived polio, paraplegics, quadriplegics. The school was almost entirely run by Moroccans. There were almost no British people there, just four of us. And the experience just completely knocked me sideways of being completely immersed in a completely different kind of culture. And so I did go back to the UK and did a degree in history as I originally planned to. But I did a lot of African history and a lot of Indian history and was exposed to reading anthropology while I was doing that and decided I would be more interested in being an anthropologist than a historian. And then in terms of my own work as an anthropologist, it's a little deviant, actually, for an anthropologist of my age. When I applied to graduate school, I was originally planning to do work in West Africa. This was in the mid-1980s. And at that moment, there was a massive anti-nuclear movement in the United States. It was sort of comparable in intensity and mood to the Black Lives Matter movement now. If you were young, progressive, politically oriented, you were concerned about nuclear weapons, you were frightened that the human race was about to wipe itself out. And so I'd become involved in the anti-nuclear movement. And when I got to graduate school, I decided this is what I'm really interested in, the nuclear arms race at the moment, not West Africa. And so I decided that the group of people I would live with, study, and write about were nuclear weapons designers, that I wanted to move to a small town in California where the main business was a nuclear weapons lab, and understand why the people at this lab felt a calling to work on weapons of mass destruction, why that was something they wanted to do.
So, you know, that's pretty interesting, you know, from spending a year in Morocco, going into undergrad, studying history, then moving on to studying nuclear weapons. That's a fairly broad range of experiences.
So when I was in graduate school, it was unusual for anthropologists to do their first field work in their own country. Often as anthropologists got older and they had families, they would do second or third field work in their own country. And it would often be with people who'd migrated from the country that they originally studied. If they'd done work in Ghana, then they would do work with Ghanaians living in Philadelphia or something like that. But it was a bit unusual for a graduate student to do that. And usually if you studied in your own country, you studied down, you know, mm-hmm. War people. So to study PhD scientists at a top secret installation was kind of deviant, but it worked out.
And, you know, one question, because, you know, looking at your past academic experience, so I think you got your master's from the University of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and then in the U.S. again at Stanford, working at several U.S. universities. What in particular captivated you to come to UBC fairly recently? That was last year, you know, leaving the East Coast of the United States, because I would assume that given the area of your work, such as on the military and weapons, that the being in the northeastern part of the United States, close to Washington, D.C., the capital, it would really be a hotbed of these sort of discussions, this type of research.
It's true. And Washington, D.C. had become a major fieldwork site for me. That was hard to give up. And it was hard to give up a community of anthropologists at my university and in Washington in general, who I'd become very attached to. I'll be candid that the United States in the last few years has kind of frightened me, the direction it took under Donald Trump in particular. And when I looked at my kids, the idea that they might have the option of citizenship in another country didn't seem like a bad idea. I've long admired the University of British Columbia. I actually interviewed for a job here about 15 years ago. I was disappointed not to have been offered that. That was at the Lou Institute. But another reason I came, I actually didn't come completely under my own steam. I came as what's known as a trailing spouse. So UBC primarily hired my wife to be the director of the New School of Public Policy and Global Affairs.
Oh.
and so we came as a package deal.
That's pretty interesting. I actually know a friend of mine who's going to be doing a Master's of Public Policy and Global Affairs starting this September. So
okay.
pretty cool to hear that. And
so you did ask how I got interested in the polygraph.
Yes.
It follows on from the nuclear weapons issue. So I wrote my first book, Nuclear Rights, about the culture of nuclear weapons scientists, about why people felt that it was just morally right to be a nuclear weapons designer. That was what I was really interested in, and the effects on their family lives of being nuclear weapons scientists, what it was like to be a devout Christian and to be a nuclear weapons scientist. When the book came out, I didn't just move on and do field work elsewhere. I've kept going back to the weapons lab that I originally studied, and I've also spent a lot of time at the other nuclear weapons lab in the US, Los Alamos. And I've been slowly working on another book about what nuclear weapons designers do now that the Cold War has ended. So I've remained engaged with that community. I have deep personal relationships with many of the scientists at both weapons labs. And one of the sort of narrative storylines that interested me had to do with the polygraph. So at the end of the 20th century, there were a number of spy scares at Los Alamos in particular. The US government came to believe that the Chinese had penetrated Los Alamos and had stolen the design for the most advanced nuclear warhead in the US stockpile, the Trident II warhead. And they came to believe that security was lax at Los Alamos in particular. And so they started polygraphing weapon scientists. In the summer of 1999, they would knock on weapon scientists' doors in the middle of the night, drive them to Albuquerque, interrogate them and polygraph them in the middle of the night to see if they were the source of leaks. And then they introduced a new requirement where weapon scientists were routinely polygraphed every few years. And this is not widely known, but we came this close to the weapon scientists in the United States going on strike over this issue. They deeply resented being polygraphed. Most of the weapon scientists don't believe that the polygraph is scientifically reliable. They'll often refer to it as witchcraft or voodoo science. And they felt their security clearances and their careers were hanging in the balance, depending on how they performed on a test that they didn't believe was scientifically valid. In the end, they acquiesced in the test. I do know of one extremely experienced nuclear weapons designer who lost his clearance for 2 years for failing a polygraph test. He eventually got it back again. But that was how I originally became interested in the polygraph issue.
That's pretty interesting, because you mentioned polygraphs being done on weapon scientists in the US. And I'm wondering, because even nowadays there is this there's a lot of discussion around, again, countries like China, Russia, and so on, you know, sending basically spies to infiltrate, you know, Western facilities, especially now in the context of, you know, coronavirus. There's been a lot of talk about medical facilities or labs being infiltrated. Have there been any cases that you've studied or you know about of polygraph tests being used outside of weapons research facility on a mass scale?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the U.S., the polygraph is used in the U.S. in lots of very different contexts. It used to be used until the late 1980s, mainly by private industry, actually. So you imagine you're a bank and you think someone has their hands in the till, and you polygraph all the cashiers and you fire the ones who fail. So up until the late 1980s, when that was made illegal in the U.S., mm-hmm. the main use of the polygraph. The polygraph has a very strange legal status in the US right now. It is not legally admissible in court. So the police can polygraph you when they interrogate you, but the prosecutor can't say he's guilty because he failed the polygraph. That would be thrown out. So it's treated as junk science in court. The private sector, private employers, are not allowed to use the polygraph on employees. To fire them. However, there are almost no police departments in the US where you can get a job without passing a polygraph. And you will not get a job working for the CIA, the FBI, most of the different intelligence agencies, the Department of Energy Weapons Labs, if you fail a polygraph test. So government agencies are allowed to use polygraph tests as job screening tests. They're allowed to re-polygraph people and potentially fire them as security risks.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you mentioned the use of private industry. And I would imagine, you know, for example, big tech companies like Apple, Microsoft, Google, you know, these are companies that would potentially want to screen employees to weed out any potential spies. Now, you mentioned that only the government is doing so. Would that mean that it's completely illegal for private companies such as these to use any sort of polygraphs?
You know, I'm not a legal expert on all of the laws, so I don't know whether they would be allowed to use the polygraph in a job screening test. But they can't fire someone mm-hmm. on them failing a polygraph test. They can't say, "We know that you've been cheating us out of money," or "That you said you were too sick to come to work, but you really played golf that because you failed a polygraph exam." But there is a context, there is a whole private industry of polygraphers as well. So marital fidelity testing is a growth industry in the US now. So private citizens who think that their husband or wife has been unfaithful can go to a private polygrapher, pay probably $300 or $400 for a polygraph test. And the polygrapher will say, "Yep, your husband's been cheating on you," or "No, they haven't been cheating on you." And the other area where polygraphs are widely used is in sporting contests, especially fishing contests. So if you imagine a fishing contest, you've got hundreds of people on boats. You can't watch them all. There are quite elaborate rules about what hours you're allowed to fish, what kind of bait you're allowed to use, and so on. So, and the prize money can be quite large. And you can forfeit that prize money if you fail a polygraph test. So I actually sat through a one-week federal trial a few years ago in Maryland. A man had won a prize of over $2 million for winning a fishing contest in Eastern Maryland. He won the White Marlin Open, and the prize money was over $2 million. And I have photographs of him with his big check grinning, photographs of him with his big fish caught grinning. And he wasn't grinning 3 days later because he and his crew all failed a polygraph test and they forfeited the $2 million. So they went to federal court to try and get the $2 million back, but they lost the court case. So another area, if you're a private polygrapher, where your services are in demand, are weightlifting contests, for example, and fishing contests. So in weightlifting contests, there are so many different steroids, it's difficult to test for all of them. So it's easier to give people a polygraph test.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it almost seems like a good way for organizations to keep their prize money. Don't have to give it away if they're winner.
Well, no, in the case of the fishing contests that I got interested in, the prize money went to the next group in line. Mm-hmm. So the guy who originally won it was CEO of a bank in Florida. You know, I got to know a lot about him. He earned $6 or $7 million a year as his salary. So I think a lot of people didn't have a lot of sympathy for him when he lost the prize money. And the prize money instead went to a bunch of firefighters.
Great. That's interesting to hear. We'll be right back here on Research Review after just one short message. So please stay tuned.
Are you one of those, I really want to make a podcast? People? Well, we've got a huge opportunity to share with you. StoryHive is giving away 10 grants of $10,000 each to aspiring podcasters in BC and Alberta. Since 2013, TELUS StoryHive has funded and supported emerging creators with mentorship and guidance from the National Screen Institute, bringing hundreds of creative Western Canadian projects to life. This time, they're taken to the airwaves with their inaugural podcast edition, dropping on November 4th. StoryHive is looking for original nonfiction podcast concept pitches from BC and Alberta residents. Make sure you apply before December 2nd at storyhive.com and you could get $10,000 to get your podcast off the ground. That's storyhive.com for all the details.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We are back here on Research Review, and today we are interviewing Dr. Hugh Gusterson. So far, we've talked a bit about his academic past, how he came to study anthropology and eventually the polygraph, and a little bit about how the polygraph has been used in the past. So, Grimon, I think you had a question for Dr. Gusterson.
Yeah. You mentioned the polygraph being used in large police departments and government agencies, and I find it kind of funny that all these agencies are advanced enough to know that the polygraph is unreliable at best.
Why do you think that's not what they think at all. No, they think it's
really.
Because
the scientific community, I would guess, it would be fairly conclusive on the fact that it's unreliable. So why do you think government agencies haven't caught on to that then?
If you look at it from the point of view of a government agency, polygraph skeptics haven't caught on to how reliable the test is and the amazing methodological advances that they've made. So the quote-unquote scientific community does not speak with one voice on this, which as an anthropologist of science is something that interests me. As an anthropologist of science, I'm always interested in controversies. When scientists all agree on something, that's kind of boring. What I'm interested in is when they disagree, how they prosecute their debates, and if the debate finally achieves closure and consensus emerges, what's the process whereby that happens? Now, scientists have been split about the polygraph for almost a century now. There are a number of psychologists who are big fans of the polygraph. And then there are others who are enormous skeptics. So I could point you to literature in referee journals that sings the praises of the polygraph. And I can point you to literature that debunks the polygraph, in both cases by psychology professors. So there are psychology professors who don't agree on this.
Now, just one question, you know, because both, you know, Grimon and I aren't really experts in polygraphs, and I assume our listeners would also have this question. In essence, how does a polygraph test even work?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that. And maybe later on you want to ask a bit about my research methods, investigating the polygraph. But the key research method that I've used is being trained as a polygrapher. Mm-hmm. Went to polygraph school. I've been polygraphed 60 times in the course of my training. I've polygraphed other people about 60 times. So it was a 10-week training course, 6 days a week, 10 hours a day. So what happens when you're polygraphed? You sit in this big armchair. They put two sort of tubes around your upper chest and your upper abdomen. And those tubes are measuring your respiration. They also attach a blood pressure cuff to your arm, usually, though it could be attached to your calf. So you've had your blood pressure taken at the doctor, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like that, except that it stays on for a lot longer. And it's measuring your blood pressure and your heartbeat. And then they put something on your third finger that measures your sweat, okay? And in the old days, they would connect all of these measuring devices to something like a little briefcase, a machine in a briefcase. And it had pens that would inscribe on an unspooling piece of. Nowadays, it's on a laptop. So on my laptop, I still have the software. You just plug these devices into your laptop. You activate the software program. And you start to see on your screen all these squiggles start appearing. So you can watch someone's breathing. You can watch someone's perspiration. And you can watch their blood pressure. And you ask different kinds of questions. Some of the questions are, if you like, calibration questions. And some of the questions are the questions you're really interested in. So basically what you do is that you ask a question where you know the person will lie. And you might know they'll lie because you said to them, I want you to lie when you answer this question. Or you might know they're going to lie because you've tricked them in various ways into lying. And part of the training is how you trick people into lying. And I'm not going to go into any more detail than that. But so you have these calibration questions where you can look at someone's heart rate and blood pressure. You can look at their breathing and you can look at their sweat when you believe you know for certain that they're lying. And then you ask them, did you put that fishing line in the water earlier than the rules allowed? Or have you been having sex with your wife's best friend? Or have you ever given a secret document to the Chinese? And they will obviously say, no, I have not had sex with my wife's best friend. No, I've never given a document to the Chinese. But you compare their breathing, their blood pressure, and their perspiration on the question you're really interested in with the question where you know they lied. And they're actually, you're not just sort of eyeballing it. They're actually objective scoring rules where you look at each component of their response, the respiration, the perspiration, the heart rate, and you give them a score comparing across the two questions. And then there are rules where if their score is more than a certain amount, they're definitely lying. If it's more than a certain amount in one direction, if it's more than a certain amount in the other direction, they're not lying. And if it's in the middle, then it's inconclusive. But so that's how a polygraph test works. You're actually doing this sort of objective scoring across these different bodily responses.
Interesting.
Yeah, I would imagine that people would, the way you're describing it, I can already think of like various ways someone could try to like trick a polygraph. Like for example, maybe artificially like modifying their respiration rate during the calibration questions, for example. How do polygraphers combat against people trying to intentionally try to game the system?
This gets into somewhat fraught terrain for me. You're quite right that people can try and trick a polygraph. And there are loads of websites out there that give often quite bad advice, but sometimes better advice on how you could trick a polygraph. And my library is full of books that I bought on Amazon, how to beat a polygraph. So there is instruction out there. And I want to emphasize for your listeners that some of the advice that's out there is really, really bad. And if you follow it, it will do you no favors. but polygraphers are well aware that these websites and these books exist. And they are constantly on the lookout for people trying to beat the polygraph. I feel they were kind enough to take me into their community for 10 weeks. There's absolutely no reason why they should have allowed me to train with them. And so I feel an obligation to be discreet about some of the knowledge that I acquired. So I think of it like learning to be a magician. And actually, I do have a good friend who's an anthropologist who trained as a magician and wrote a book about the anthropology of magic. And he's very careful in the book not to tell you how the magic tricks are done. And so I'm not going to tell you which ways of beating the polygraph might work better than others and how polygraphers have learned to spot them. I will just say that one of my 10 weeks of training was about how you beat people who are trying to beat the polygraph. And so if there are countermeasures, there are also counter-countermeasures.
It's pretty interesting. We'll be right back here on Research Review after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us, minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Today on Research Review, we've been interviewing Dr. Hugh Gusterson, a professor of anthropology at UBC. And so far, we've been talking a bit about the polygraph test and a bit about the effectiveness of the polygraph, a bit about how it's administered. Now, one question, because I think you said you did most of your research in the United States, right? Is the polygraph used as widely in other countries around the world for similar purposes?
It's not used as widely in other countries, but it is used in at least 50 or 60 different countries. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting is that the way it's used often varies by country. I'll give you an example. So in Japan, for example, there is only one extremely specialized kind of polygraph test that it is legal to use. That's what's called the guilty knowledge test. So let's say that you have someone who you think stabbed someone. So you're polygraphing them and you show them pictures of different knives. And one of the knives is the knife that was used to stab the victim. The theory there is that when they see that particular knife, they'll sweat more, the heart rate will go up and so on. So the theory is that when they see that particular object, it will send them over the edge. So that's the only polygraph test that you're allowed to use. And interestingly enough, the people who train me don't like that test. They don't think it's reputable. They don't think it's reliable. They advise people not to use it. But in Japan, it's believed to be the only reliable and reputable test. And the kinds of tests that I was trained to do with people, where you ask people if they've ever broken a law, you're not allowed to use in Japan. Mm-hmm. American polygraph schools are now teaching more and more people from other countries. When I took a class, about a third of the class was from Malaysia. They were Malaysian police officers being trained to polygraph people under interrogation in Malaysia, which poses some interesting challenges because Malaysia is a predominantly Muslim country, and men are not supposed to touch women or to be alone with strange women. So it's no problem for a male polygrapher in the US to polygraph a female subject on their own. That poses problems in Malaysia. So they would have to have a female assistant attaching the sensors to a female's body and so on. They had particular questions they were interested in about whether people had used alcohol, which would be non-questions in the US context. But yes, the polygraph is used in many other countries, and There are other countries with their own training programs. There's a training school in Singapore. There's a very highly regarded training school in Israel. There's a training school that recently began in the UK. The polygraph is becoming more and more widely used in Latin America, in Mexico, Colombia, places like that.
Has the polygraph become more reliable over time? I know there's always been some sort of scientific debate over the validity of a polygraph, but has it? I'm assuming it's gotten only better as time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, I think most, even people who don't think it's reliable would say it's more reliable than it was, say, in the 1950s. And the advances don't really have to do so much with any of the sensors. What's interesting is that the sensors that are used to measure breathing, heart rate, and perspiration, those sensors were basically set in the 1940s. They're maybe a little bit more accurate than they used to be, but that hasn't changed so much. The change is more around the way the questions are phrased, increasing rigor in the phrasing of questions, and lots of testing out in psychology labs of different kinds of question phraseology, and then changes in the way scoring of the answers is done. That's really where most of the changes happened. And in the ordering of the questions, the sequencing of the questions, there's been some improvement there. You did ask about the scientific community and what the scientific community thinks about this. The closest we have to an official opinion from quote unquote the scientific community is a report that was done in the 1990s by the National Academy of Sciences. So they convened an expert panel to look into it. And that expert panel concluded in the context of the 1990s that the polygraph was probably about 70 to 80% accurate. So more accurate than a coin toss, but much less than completely accurate, right? And so the National Academy of Sciences pointed out, this is a real dilemma. I mean, it's clearly a lot more accurate than chance. It's somewhat useful, but it's not as accurate as you would want it to be if you're going to convict someone of a crime or you're going to fire someone, right? So it's in that gray zone where it's not quite clear what you would do with it. So many polygraphers will say that, okay, you wouldn't fire someone based only on a polygraph, but the police often use a polygraph when they interrogate someone, and you can often confront someone who's been interrogated with their polygraph result, and they will confess. And so if they've confessed, then you can convict them because they confessed. And in court, you wouldn't even mention that they were polygraphed. You would just use the confession, but you wouldn't have got the confession without the polygraph test in the first case. So it can be a tool to break someone down. Now we know that people sometimes falsely confess. They confess to things they didn't do. The Central Park Five, right? Bunch of black teenagers confessed to raping a white jogger. They were eventually exonerated after several years in prison. They falsely confessed to a crime they didn't commit, because they were intimidated by the police. And a polygraph can be an instrument of intimidation. So there is a problem there. But I would also point out that in medicine, we use tests that are about that reliable, right? So mammograms are not infallible, right? There are a lot of false positives and some false negatives with mammograms. And yet no one says we shouldn't use mammograms. X-rays, lung x-rays, often miss tumors. So there are false negatives there.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about the
comparison. Two radiographers read a lung x-ray and they won't always agree. Sorry. So one of the things that interests me about the polygraph is it's sort of epistemological weirdness. Government agencies can use it, private industries can't. it can cost you a job with the police, but a private employer isn't allowed to use it to fire you. It sort of is reliable, more than chance, but it sort of isn't reliable. It's a lot less than perfect. Some people really believe in it. The people who train me are almost fanatical in the belief that they have invested in it. Other people think it's junk. It's this strange, amorphous, shape-shifting thing.
Because, now, one question I have is, what would you comment about how the polygraph is portrayed in popular media, like films and television? Because I've seen, you know, the so-called like lie detector test in several like TV shows being used previously, for example, when they catch a criminal or a spy. So how do you think the way it is portrayed, is that accurate or is it inaccurate? And how do you think that shapes public opinion about polygraphs?
I do know that the polygraphers who trained me and the polygraphers I trained with, they're often driven crazy when they see a polygraph scene, you know, in the series 24 or something like that. I'm watching a French series right now, Le Bureau, which is about the French CIA. And they have all these polygraph scenes, which are completely inaccurate. No polygrapher would ever use a polygraph the way it's shown being used in that series. So often polygraphers are driven a little bit crazy by what they see. But usually in popular culture, the polygraph tends to be portrayed pretty generously, I think. It's portrayed as a pretty reliable technology. There is a scene in The Americans, if you've ever watched this great spy show, The Americans, where a Russian who has infiltrated the FBI is polygraphed by the FBI to see if she's a Russian agent. She is a Russian agent, but her Russian handler coaches her on a countermeasure for passing the polygraph. And all I will say is it's a countermeasure that does work, or did work at the time, but there are now countermeasures. So if your polygrapher is competent, it won't work anymore. But it is interesting. It shows someone beating the polygraph through a technique that would enable you to beat one if your polygrapher wasn't on the alert for it. I've been particularly interested, I have to confess my guilty pleasure. I love watching things like the Jerry Springer Show, you know, these daytime shows where people come and scream that their girlfriend is cheating on them and so on, Dr. Phil. Mm-hmm. And they often have a resident polygrapher. And I did interview Dr. Phil's polygrapher before he died. He passed away a couple of years ago. The people who trained me are driven crazy by those shows. They do not believe that the polygraphs administered on those shows meet professional standards. And they wish that they didn't use the polygraph the way that they do. But Dr. Phil and all those people treat the polygraph as infallible. And I've noticed that the guests do as well, and so does the audience.
I think that's true. You know, I think based upon what I've seen personally in the media so far, the polygraph is treated as fairly accurate across a wide range of both, you know, fictional and nonfiction works. So I think that's interesting. I think that does shape public perception as well. You know,
it's treated as an almost magical technology that can peer into your mind.
Do you think that sort of contributes to the effectiveness of the polygraph? It almost works as like a placebo, as you, like you mentioned earlier, it can be used for like intimidation. Like if you think someone knows what you're really thinking, then you're more likely to confess. Do you think media has an effect on like creating that sort of idea?
Yeah, I do. I do think that popular culture has helped produce that. And, you know, having been polygraphed myself, you get into this sort of trance-like state. And I mean, some polygraphers are not very competent, but if you have a really good, really competent polygrapher, it's not just that they know how to attach the sensors and they know how to score really quickly. It's in this sort of relationship that they develop with you, where they almost hypnotize you into believing that they can look into the recesses of yourself and find your hidden secrets. So a really good polygrapher, I think, conveys that sort of aura of infallibility and all-knowingness.
That's pretty cool. We'll be right back here on Research Review after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
Tune in to African Rhythms every Friday from 7:30 to 9 o'clock with your host, David Love Jones, as he plays a heavyweight selection of classics from the past, present, and future. This includes jazz, soul, hip-hop, Afro-Latin, funk, and eclectic Brazilian rhythms. Lots of people, they
take it like a game. You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Al Rott, and along with my co-host, Hugh Ramon, today we are interviewing Dr. Hugh Gusterson, a professor of anthropology at UBC. We've been talking a bit about the polygraph test today, and so far we just talked a bit about how the polygraph is used around the world, and a bit about how the polygraph is portrayed in media as well. So, Gurman, I think you had a question for Dr. Gusterson.
Where do you think you've studied the polygraph test more than almost anyone in the world? Where do you think the polygraph should be in society in general? Do you think it should be used by government agencies and private agencies, admissible in court? What's your personal opinion?
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to do what Americans call taking the fifth on that. The way I want to write my book on the polygraph, I want to write it so that if you don't believe in the polygraph, you find the book compelling. And if you do believe in the polygraph, you find the book compelling. And so I don't want to sort of announce my own position, at least at this point, on how the polygraph might or might not be used. I want the reader to have to do some work and struggle with that for themselves.
Now, you know, just one last question out of curiosity talking about this, because, you know, one thing that happens at UBC and other universities sometimes is cheating incidents. And, you know, we've seen a few incidents happen this year, especially with online school. There was one actually that was publicized in news of around, I think, 100 or so math students in first year all cheating on an exam. And in a lot of these cases, for example, if you have several students like conspiring to cheat together on an exam, it can be hard to find concrete evidence as to this sort of academic misconduct. So have you ever seen or heard about any instances where a polygraph test has been used to basically combat academic dishonesty, cheating, any sort of that in academic institutions?
I'm not aware of that. That's a really interesting question. I'm not aware of any North American university, for example, doing that. Be interesting to know if foreign universities have tried to do that. You know, if you can polygraph people on whether they cheated on their spouse, why not on whether they cheated on their math test?
That's true. And, you know, in a way, even though the polygraph isn't 100% accurate, I would say that compared to some other sorts of evidence that could be gathered to, I guess, support cheating allegations, it could be more accurate than those forms. So,
you know, I'm aware that we're having this conversation in the shadow of Proctorio.
Yes, and yes.
UBC in particular, this software program, Proctorio, that some faculty used to look for online cheating in real time, has been very controversial. There are questions about whether it can be outwitted. I know that some students experience it as very intrusive because if you're a female student, you're often asked to scan your lap, for example, to show that you don't have notes or books on your lap. Students who are a little neurodiverse can get flagged by it because they blink a lot or they look away. So I've not said where I stand on the polygraph, but I will say that I'm not a fan of Proctorio. I don't think it's good software. I think it has a lot of problems in terms of invading privacy, of discriminating against minoritized students in one way or another. And I think if a faculty member is concerned about cheating, there are other measures they can take. So I set a final exam in my class last term. It was open note and open book. So students were welcome to look at notes, welcome to look at their books. It was also very time constrained. So students who'd studied would spend a lot of time looking in their notes and they'd run out of time. Students who knew the material probably wouldn't look in the notes very much and they'd do fine. So I think that's a much better way of dealing with cheating. There was an incident recently where a bunch of students were thrown out of Dartmouth Medical School because of proctorio. Not because of proctorio, sorry. A different program flagged them for having cheated. And, someone pointed out, when you go to a doctor, you don't say to the doctor, I won't take your advice if you go and look it up. You don't know, you want them to look it up, right? You want them to know how to look things up. So why can't they look stuff up in a medical exam?
That's interesting.
One last question I had is, you mentioned that the physiological way of administering a polygraph hasn't really changed over the years. But is there maybe like new methods coming out that maybe like would create a polygraph 2.0 in a way where they're looking at other ways to administer lie detector tests? Like I read about maybe like fMRI tests, for example, being used as a potential lie detector. Do you know any other examples?
Yes, I do. So fMRI tests have been experimented with. They would be incredibly expensive. Unless the price really comes down, that's not really a contender. But there is a technology called iDetect, which I've become quite interested in. And I actually took a polygraph test. I tried to beat the iDetect test and I could not. So what happens with iDetect, you put your chin on a sort of chin rest. You stare into a laptop and the camera is taking pictures of your eyeballs, and it's taking pictures of them like 80 times a second while you're being asked questions. And I don't know about you, I can't control at will the contraction of my pupils and things like that. So the test that I took, and I was offered $10 if I could beat the machine, I was told to pick a number between 1 and 10, write it down on a piece of paper, fold it up and put it in my pocket so no one knew but me. And then I was told to look into the camera, and I had these headphones on, and the computer asked me, is your number number one? Is your number number two? Is your number number three? Is your number number four? And I was told to say no every time. So 8 times I told the truth. It wasn't my number. And 1 time I lied. It was my number, but I said it wasn't. And at the end of it, the computer said your number was 6, and it was right, which really kind of freaked me out. I do know a polygraph trainer who claims to have beaten the test. Traditional polygraphers really don't like iDetect because it's automating what they do. So you can have one guy who's got 8 laptops running at once, right? So instead of needing 8 polygraphers, you just need 1 polygrapher. And the computer is doing all the scoring and all the question asking. So there's no such thing as a polygrapher's union, but if there was, they would really be fighting this because it threatens to automate them out of business. But the big controversy in the community in the next 10 years is going to be how reliable iDetect is and whether it's more or less reliable than a person. Maybe I could say one more thing. You said I'm the only anthropologist that you've interviewed. And anthropologists do have this unique way of doing research. And so maybe I should just say something to your listeners about how an anthropologist goes about doing research. Our principal research method is participant observation, or as it's otherwise known, deep hanging out. So we just try and hang out with people and watch them as they do what they do with them, and take notes on it. We might take notes in real time, or if that feels too intrusive, we might take notes from memory afterwards. But a lot of what we do is we just hang out with people and try and experience the world they experienced. So that's why I did my training as a polygrapher. But we also interview people a lot. So I've interviewed polygraphers, and I've interviewed a lot of people who've been polygraphed. If I can, I go to the annual meeting of the American Polygraph Association every year, and you'll find me at the bar trying to meet polygraphers and chat with them about interesting experiences they've had. And I watch a lot of trashy daytime TV to see is portrayed there. So rigorous or not, that's my research method.
Excellent. Thanks for joining our show today. We really appreciate the conversation we had. Lots of interesting stuff discussed.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. So today we interviewed Dr. Hugh Gusterson, a professor of anthropology at UBC, and we talked a bit about his research on the polygraph. We hope you tune in 2 weeks from now on July 21st when we interview Dr. Lisa Holstie.